You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to All Creatures Podcast. I am Angie, and today we will be talking all about sharks and their behavior and their conservation with my guest, Dr. Yannis Papastamatiou. Did I say that right?
You did.
Okay, great. Yannis is a nationally acclaimed shark researcher and professor from Florida International University. And Dr. Papastamatiou is one of the world's leading shark behavioral ecologists. His work has been featured on National Geographic, BBC, and Discovery Channel. And on All Creatures Podcast, we always celebrate and support our ocean creatures during the month of July, which is also timed perfectly with National Geographic's Shark Fest, which features incredible shark-themed programming for the whole month of July, kicking off July 2nd. And we are so excited to be featuring Yanni here because he is featured on three programs, including When Sharks Attack 360, Sharkano, Hawaii, and Bull Shark versus Hammerhead. So as we celebrate our oceans and the people working to understand and conserve the species that inhabit the ocean, I'm just so very, very happy to have Dr. Papastamatiou, or Yanni, as I'll call him from now, on the podcast today, helping us navigate shark behavior, since sharks often can get a bad name in the oceans. So everyone, please, please, please welcome Yanni here to the podcast. It's so great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And as we get started, I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what is your background and how did you become this nationally acclaimed shark researcher?
Well, so I'm actually born and raised in London. So I came from a landlocked city, grew up in London. I had, half Greek father. And so I actually moved to Greece when I was 11 and spent, my teenage years living in Athens in Greece before then moving back to the UK to go to university. And I've always loved sharks, and I've always had this sort of had this goal of, eventually being able to study sharks. And so I was very driven by that. And I'd always kind of wanted to go to the US, but especially this was, 25 years ago. The US was really one of the sort of epicenters for shark research at the time. And so it still is, but now there's other countries that have a lot more shark research, but not so much back then. So I made my way over to the US. I went to graduate school, did my master's, my PhD in the States, and then, took a variety of different postdoctoral positions, moved around to various universities before getting a faculty position at Florida International University.
And now you mentioned that you always wanted to work with sharks. So you must have been born with that. Like I was born with always wanting to work with and ride horses, and my parents tried to have me not do it because it was expensive and dangerous. But it was in me. And so did you have an aha moment in the ocean? Obviously, probably not in London, but maybe when you're in Greece or in the ocean that you fell in love with sharks, or was it more from like TV or programming?
I don't remember having an aha moment. I remember always being like, I absolutely love being in the water. So my mum took, like, you know, basically taught me to swim when, you know, when I was still learning to walk almost. And so I've always loved being in the water. I'd spend my summers in Greece, even when I was living in London, and learn to snorkel in the waters of Greece, which are beautiful, clear waters, often not too many big fish, but, you know, still very, very nice conditions to learn to snorkel in. And I think my kind of love for the ocean came from that. And I just remember being around about, I think, five when I started to get this fascination with sharks. And it just grew from there. So I always wanted to learn to dive. That was like the really only thing I cared about, was learning to dive and being able to study sharks. But there were a couple of programs that also were pretty influential on me. One of them actually being Jaws. Like, I know obviously Jaws scared a lot of people, and it was very effective as a horror film. But I actually was quite inspired by the character of Hooper, you know, played by Richard Dreyfuss, who was a marine biologist in that film. And that was actually quite inspirational to me. And the other thing that was a really big inspiration was actually National Geographic's documentary on sharks that came out. I don't remember the exact date. It was early 80s. And keep in mind that back then, shark documentaries were very rare, right? Now everybody does it. Everybody's in the water diving with sharks. But in the 80s, that was it. It was a different story. So there was this one big documentary, had Valerie Taylor testing out her chainmail suit. Eugenie Clark was in it. And it was an incredible documentary. I had the VHS. It was a video cassette. And I just used to watch that thing until I pretty much ruined it. And that was extremely important for me and pushing me and sort of guiding me into this sort of job career that I've managed to make for myself.
Well, and I definitely want to jump into your career and the programs that you're featured in National Geographic this month. But before we do, I know that you have swam and dove all over the world for your research. So I just have to pick your brain a little bit and ask if you have a favorite dive site or a shark interaction story for our listeners.
I do. And again, I've been very fortunate to dive all over the world and some incredible places. I would say the two that stand out the most to me is one is Fakarava Atoll, which is in French Polynesia. And we actually did it was a filming / research expedition there over 2 years. And it led to a film called 700 Sharks, which was actually on National Geographic, which was an incredible piece of work. And there we were studying the hunting behavior of gray reef sharks. So we used to dive at night in this channel. We were diving with what are called closed circuit rebreathers, which are basically breathing apparatus with no bubbles. It recycles your gas. It's almost like the same thing an astronaut would use. So there's no bubbles. So you can stand in water for a long period of time. And because there's no bubbles, you don't really disturb the animals as much. But what was so incredible about this place was that at night you had 300, 400 hunting gray reef sharks. It was just kicking off. I mean, it was like nothing I've ever seen in my life. I mean, they were just tearing the reef to pieces. I think up until then, I'd maybe seen one or two natural predation events in the wild where you actually see a shark hunting something. It's very rare to see. And on that dive, you'd see 15, 20 predation events on one dive. I mean, it just was a tornado of volcanic eruption of sharks. And it really, to that day, I remember doing that dive for the first time and just coming out of the water and just being speechless. And keep in mind, this was after, you know, I had over 20 years of diving with sharks under my belt at that point. And another dive that really did stand out to me is also the Galapagos and Wolf Island, which is, again, very remote location. You know, no one lives there. You can't even get on land. So it's very remote and it's well known for the schooling scalloped hammerhead sharks. And again, it was a filming / research trip. We were using rebreathers again and being on the reef and just having this continuous wall of sharks. I would say, I mean, between several hundred to have perhaps 1,000 sharks were in that group. And it just was walls of hammerhead just going past, just left to right, continuously. You just didn't know where to look next. And so those two really stand out. But I've also been to many other spectacular places, Guadalupe Island with white sharks. I just got back from Fiji diving with bull sharks, oceanic white tips in the Bahamas. And those were all exceptional experiences. But if you were to ask me my top two, it'd probably be those two dives.
Wow, Yannis, you paint such a visual picture. I almost feel like I was in the water with you seeing that, although not quite that cool. But I, man, that sounds just, like you said, just stunning. Like, you don't even know where to look next, and you're getting to see these predation events and just beautiful. I mean, wow. And looking at your research, you do study several different species of fish as you throughout your entire career. So I was wondering if you could highlight some of the shark species that you have studied and what your current research and interests are.
Yeah, so I like to keep my research interests broad. And so although the majority of my work with sharks, I don't only work with sharks. I also work with other fish, do a lot of work with grouper, other coral reef fish, pelagic fishes, and then even some big reptile predators. I've worked with alligators, for example. So I try and keep it sort of...
That's because you're in Florida, broad. Right?
that is because I was in Florida, yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you want to study predators, you've got to include some big reptiles if you live here. But I've studied many different species. As I said, I've worked with white sharks. I worked a lot with reef sharks, especially in the Pacific, gray reef shark, black tip reef shark. Those are actually species I did my PhD on. I've worked a lot with oceanic white tip sharks. I've worked with the small cookie cutter sharks. I've worked with some of the deep sea sharks. I really try to include a wide range of different species. At the moment, the two major species I have projects running with are with actually great hammerheads, which cool. Again are a species mm-hmm. we get around Florida. We see them quite often. And then bull sharks. So I've started a bull shark research project in Florida, and also, you know, just getting involved with some bull shark work in Fiji. And then there's several other species I'm also working with, like scalloped hammerhead sharks, doing some work with silver tip sharks, silky sharks, white tip reef sharks. But the two biggest projects I have will be with this sort of gray hammerheads and bull sharks.
And now, Yannis, can you explain a couple shark behaviors, since you've been studying them for so long, that people might not be familiar with? Like, most people probably think sharks swim, they hunt stuff, and that's it. So what are some things about sharks and their behavior that might surprise us?
Yeah, so, you know, we I've learned a lot about sharks over the last few decades. And we've come to realize that this old, you know, this image of them being killing machines and, you know, with humans on the menu is really not correct. You know, they really are like that. Very, very few species of sharks. And I'll talk about this in a little bit, but very few species of sharks will actually include humans, you know, in their diet. Very, very, very few. So it's very rare for that to happen. And I think you can really see that by the fact that if, you know, you can go in the water with these animals and for the most part, nothing would happen. Whereas you wouldn't really want to go and do the same with lions or grizzly bears. You wouldn't go and hang out with them in close proximity because the chance of something bad happening is probably pretty high. But with most sharks, you can do that and probably get away with it. I'm not saying you should, but just that you could. But, you know, interesting thing is we found a lot about recently, for example, is we're learning a lot now about the social lives of sharks. You know, people might not think of sharks as being social animals. Social animals, I mean, the animals like to hang out with each other. So when I talk about social animals, you might think of like a pack of wolves, or pride of lions, or a flock of birds, or a colony of ants. But you might not think of sharks as being social, but we have now started to find out over the last 10 years, especially, that we have evidence that these are actually social animals. You may have sharks that like to hang out with other individuals, and you may sometimes have the same individuals that hang out with each other for years. So surprising levels of sociality. We've also found things out, for example, that there's some sharks which are kind of omnivorous. Like, for example, the bonnethead shark, which is a type of hammerhead we get in coastal waters around Florida. And we're able to show that they were able to digest and assimilate seagrass. So we always knew they had seagrass in their stomachs. They like to eat crabs. Crabs are their favorite prey item. And so, you know, it was always assumed, it's probably correct, that the seagrass is incidental. As they're scooping up a crab, they get seagrass in their diet. And we always thought, you know, they don't have the ability to digest seagrass, so it's just in the gut. But then we showed that they can. So I'm not saying that they're going out and grazing like cows, but they are able to actually acquire energy from seagrass. And therefore that is kind of, you know, even if it's incidental, become a component of their diet. And we continue to find, you know, amazing new things. There was a study by some colleagues of mine very recently showing that hammerhead sharks, scalloped hammerheads that will dive to 1,000 meters, which we knew that for a while. We knew that they could do these really deep dives. It was very cold. And what they actually showed is they actually get to a certain depth and then they hold their breath. They close their gill slits. So there's no water flowing over the gills. And that's because if you allow water to flow over the gills, you also lose a lot of body heat. So those sharks would lose too much body heat if they went to that depth with the gills open. So even though they're in water, they're obviously an animal that, you know, doesn't need to breathe air. They still have to hold their breath to go and do these deep dives, presumably to hunt, which will also limit how long they can spend down there because they're essentially holding their breath.
So incredible. I'm just a huge shark fan. I studied mammals, but the more I've been doing this podcast, the more I keep learning about the physiology and the behavior of fish and bird and reptiles and other creatures that just keep blowing my mind at some of their physiological feats and also their behavior. And then the fact that there's so much that we don't know about them. I know, like with great whites, we're just learning about where their their nurseries are, right? Like we don't even necessarily know where some of their nurseries are. There's still so much to learn about these species of sharks. And so we definitely appreciate all of your work on them. And I know for a lot of people, when they see sharks or they go to the ocean or they think of sharks, a lot of us think of Jaws or think of Sharknado or basically a bad connotation with sharks. They're often vilified in pop culture. So you as a shark expert that's had hundreds of thousands swimming around you when you're diving, why should people care about sharks and why should we want to protect them?
Yeah, so there is, you know, there is obviously this fear of sharks. And I mean, it's not surprising. I'm not a psychologist, but it's not surprising because, you know, these are animals that occasionally, very rarely act as predators. And again, that's very, very rare, but it does happen. And I think what makes it worse for people's sort of perceptions is that this takes place in a medium that we're not comfortable in, right? We have not evolved to be in water. So if you're in water, even the best human swimmer is not, relatively speaking, is still pretty poor, a poor swimmer compared to fish or marine mammal. We can't see under the water unless we have a mask. And so you're in this environment where it's, you know, there's this unknown. You can't see what's beneath you. You don't know what's beneath you. And it's easy for these to put those two together and have this sort of unusual fear for sharks, more so than you would for, let's say, bears or tigers or terrestrial predators, which, again, is on an environment that we can understand. So, again, I understand where that fear might come from. But it is important to understand that, you know, these animals probably have a really important role in the ecosystem. And to be clear, we don't fully know what that is. You spoke about how much there's still to figure out. And that's kind of an understatement. I mean, we still know very, very little about these animals. And I hate having to do interviews where I'm always like, well, we don't know. We don't know. We don't know. We don't know.
Right.
But
yes.
I'm going to say the truth. We don't know. We don't know. And so there's a lot of things we don't know. And one thing we don't have a good idea on is exactly what is the ecological role of these animals. That's not going to be the same. So the ecological importance of a great white shark might be very different to a horned shark, for example. And I'm not even saying which one is going to be more important than the other. We don't know. But that role is going to be different. What I will say is that shark environments or waters with healthy shark populations means you have healthy ecosystems. Pretty much one of the warning signs we have for a lot of ecosystems that they are no longer healthy is that there's no sharks there. There should be sharks in the ecosystem, unless you're talking about the Antarctic, where they probably aren't. And so it is definitely an indicator of a healthy ecosystem. And although it may not alleviate your concerns about going in the water, if you are in an area where there's lots of sharks, at least you know that you have a reasonably healthy ecosystem in your backyard.
Yeah. And so what are the statistics and how often do sharks attack? How often are they fatal? I know it's really low. I feel like your chance is lower than getting struck with lightning or something or being killed by a cow. But what are we looking at here for the numbers?
So I think the average numbers worldwide are 70 to 80 or so shark bites a year. And of those, you're probably looking at maybe 5 to 10 are fatal. So the vast majority are not fatal. And again, keep in mind what these statistics mean, because 70 to 80 people worldwide and think how many people are going into the water and think how many sharks are in the water. And that's all you get, right? That's a very, 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 very small number. So when you do look at it from a pure statistics standpoint, it is, again, much smaller than the chance of being, let's say, killed by a coconut falling from a tree. But saying that, we also have to recognize that that chance isn't equal, right? There's certain places where the chance is going to be higher. There's certain activities.
Hello, Florida.
Florida has some of the most shark bites, but generally the vast majority of those shark bites are from very small pieces of shark. So sure. It still can be a nasty bite. You go to hospital, but very rarely do we have fatalities. Obviously, we do have some. We do have some more serious injuries from bigger sharks, but the majority of our bites are from smaller animals. You have other places like Reunion Island, for example, where they had several years of a series of fatal shark attacks. And so obviously, the probability of getting bitten in Reunion was probably going to be significantly higher than some of these statistics we're giving. So you do have to take into that context that, yes, statistics at a broad scale are nice, but those aren't going to be the same. Some places are going to have higher, some places are going to have lower chances of getting bitten. But again, it is very small, regardless of which way you look.
Yeah. And I grew up on Lake Michigan. And so one of the t-shirts I wear says, Lake Michigan, no salt, no sharks.
And that's, that is ultimately, you know, I often get asked as advice as to how to avoid getting bitten by a shark. And there is some advice we can give, but ultimately the only way to guarantee you won't get bitten by a shark is to not go in the ocean. And that's really the only guarantee that can be given.
Yes, but I grew up a Lake Michigan girl, but now living in Florida, I go in the ocean. I am fully comfortable. And honestly, I'm more worried about the seaweed or other creatures than I am sharks, to be honest.
And I would be more worried about physical processes in the ocean than I would the animals. I mean, much more of a concern for me when diving in Florida is getting lost, because we have some strong currents and, you know, we have rip currents and things like that. So I always... To put it into perspective, you know, obviously the ocean isn't a swimming pool, and that's not just in regards to the animals and the absence of animals in swimming pools. I mean, you also have things like very strong currents, and yet we don't have the same approach. When somebody goes for a swim in the ocean and gets caught in a current and drowns, we don't blame the ocean for having these strong currents, but we do have this sort of response when a shark bites somebody of wanting to blame the animal, when obviously it doesn't do anything from malicious intent. Now, the reasons why it bit that person can be varied. And again, often we don't know. But one thing I can guarantee, it wasn't because it wanted to cause them harm for the sake of causing them harm.
Yeah. And now switching gears a little bit, Yannis, you're a featured scientist on three of National Geographic's Shark Fest this month of July. So you're featured on When Sharks Attack 360. So we already talked about that a little bit, but you're also featured on Sharkano, Hawaii, and also Hammerheads versus Bull Sharks. So I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about National Geographic Shark Fest programming and what it was like to be featured on these shows and how the filming was.
Yeah, so I've been, you know, I think I do a couple of Shark Fest shows each year. And again, it kind of comes full circle for me, because part of the reason I got into this line of work was from a National Geographic documentary. So it's kind of a life, one of those funny things in life where you're now part of the story that kind of got you started. And so that's always been special to me. And then not just with the filming side of things, I mean, National Geographic, the research side of things has funded several of my projects as well. So I've got three or four research projects funded by National Geographic. So I've had this quite close relationship with them for a while. And, you know, I think filming is its own sort of unique experience, and it's a learning skill. You know, being on camera, it's no longer just about doing science anymore. It's about doing science, but also being able to convey it. And whether I'm good or bad at it, I don't know, but it is a skill in itself. And science communication and knowing, you know, how to speak to the camera and how to phrase things in ways that people will understand, that is a skill that's almost separate from the actual, you know, ability to do science or good science. They're not the same thing.
Well, you must be doing a pretty good job of it, considering they keep having you back to discuss sharks in your research. So,
hopefully,
I think so. Well, we'll let our listeners be the judge of that. Would you mind giving us just a little brief synopsis on what when sharks attack 360 Sharkano, Hawaii? I'm really interested in that one. What are those about?
And first of all, to say for all these shows, I'm just one component of the show. And so there's often multiple different components that will go into a show. It's obviously not just me. So when sharks attack, look at how we can use a scientific study of shark behavior to inform what kind of goes on during shark attacks on humans, or when might be riskier time for humans to be in the water. So particularly looking at things like, is there a certain time of day when it's more dangerous to be in the water? Is there certain seasonal times when it's more dangerous to be in the water? So using our scientific study of the behavior of these animals to kind of help inform the public to ways that perhaps, even if it's just slightly, reduce the risk of getting bit.
Sure.
So that was the main focus of that story. The Sharkano one is looking at the sort of the behavior and ecology of sharks around Hawaii, which is obviously, you know, and especially the Big Island of Hawaii, which
that's not a bad gig to hang out.
Active. No. So I did my PhD in Hawaii. So I actually lived in Hawaii for 7 years. So a lot of time working
there. Island?
I lived on Oahu. So cool. I did my PhD there, but I worked a lot on the Big Island. And then I also did a lot of work in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands, which are uninhabited atolls. So I used to go up there each year. So the Sharkano looks at the behavior of sharks around, you know, the island of Hawaii. And my particular area was actually looking at some of the schooling hammerhead sharks that actually form off those islands. So I did some work there. And then the bull shark versus hammerhead is, you know, off of Florida, we have these two pretty iconic species. We get bull sharks, we get great hammerheads in the same waters. And they're likely to be competing with each other because they're going to include the same sort of prey items. You're probably not going to get them preying on each other. Great hammerheads are, you know, well-known shark killers. They like to eat shark, but they're not going to be going after adult bull sharks. They're eating smaller species like black tips. But nonetheless, you can have these areas with bulls and hammerheads together. And the question is, you know, what happens when you have these two sort of iconic predators come together? So for that, I was really focusing on the bull shark side of things, looking at some aspects of their behavior.
Wow. I look forward to all the programming, of course, but if I was betting lady, I think I would place my bets on the great hammerhead. So I don't know. We'll have to tune in to find out, right?
I'll leave it to you know, and again, you know, not necessarily that these two go to war with each other, because that's not really what sharks do.
Sure.
And it's an interesting point of things, because, you know, when we look at interactions between animals, and we look at contest between animals, you can think of like males fighting over a female in deer, or in snakes, where the males will, you know, go through an elaborate dance to see who gets the female. And you see these contests, and you will often get animals don't necessarily want to actually get to the fighting stage. They'll get to the stage where they display, like they puff their chests up, where they avoid the actual conflict. But occasionally they do end up having conflict, and sometimes you get individuals seriously injured or killed. But we very rarely see that with sharks. Even when we have competitive interactions, very, very rarely, you may see some agonistic displays between them, but very rarely do you see actual physical contact and one causing serious harm to the other. So they seem to get along better with each other than a lot of other animals.
Yeah, they know to stay in their lane, which is
they stay in their lane.
Us humans
for the most
could
part.
Learn.
Yeah.
Could learn a little bit to do.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
And Giannis, I want to talk a little bit about shark conservation since you're the expert. You're out there diving. You've been diving for years. Talking to world experts about sharks. We do know that millions of sharks are pulled out of the water each year. So I was wondering if you could give us a brief overview on shark conservation. Is the population declining as a whole, or are there certain species that are threatened and endangered that we should keep our eye on? I wonder if you could touch on that.
Yeah, so on average, we estimate there's about 100 million sharks a year being killed. And obviously, that's an average.
Oh, wow. 100 million. Okay.
Yeah, it could be a bit less, could be a bit more. Wow. But that's the average. And we know the latest assessments say that, you know, perhaps up to a third of species of sharks, you know, could be threatened with, you know, either are endangered or becoming endangered. And so that's very concerning. And the numbers are probably higher than that because for a lot of species, it's very difficult to assess if they are actually at the endangered or critically endangered level just because we have so little data on them that you can't really make an assessment. So more than likely that number is higher. So shark populations worldwide, there are shark populations worldwide that are threatened and we are seeing declines in their populations. And the reason sharks are quite susceptible is if we look at their life history, they grow slowly. They don't reproduce very often. Most of the females have actually, you know, internal reproduction. So the baby shark develops inside the mother. And that also means they have very long gestation periods, sometimes comparable to humans. So if you compare that to other fish that will, you know, reproduce very frequently, have lots and lots of offspring, grow very rapidly. When you have a life strategy like that, you can deal more when you have increased mortality from fishing, right? You can deal with increased levels of fatalities from fishing. When you grow very slowly, like the sharks do with that slow reproduction, they can't cope very well with that extra mortality we put on them through fishing activities where we remove them. And so that's why often you see the decline in population sizes. But also to be clear, it's not true to say all sharks are endangered. That's not a true statement. There are certainly shark populations that are doing well. There are fisheries, especially in places like the US and Australia, where the shark fisheries are sustainable, meaning you can fish them and the population sizes are stable. And the reason is because they're well managed, they're well regulated. And that means that, you do see these sustainable fisheries. And that's not true for all species. There are certain species that they just could not take any fishing pressure at all. And we don't fish them, great whites being an example, at least in US. But there are some populations that are doing much better. But it is true that overall, there are a lot of shark populations that are of great concern. Well, the hammerhead sharks, for example, we're very concerned about. Oceanic white tips is another species that we're getting pretty concerned about. Silky shark. But there's quite a few species that are certainly of great concern from a conservation standpoint.
And you mentioned the U.S. doing some regulations on shark fishing. Is there anything else that are any other types of regulations being put into place either nationally or internationally to help sharks? Or new technologies to help mm-hmm. study them? What does that look like?
Yeah, there's quite a lot of things, actually. And again, I should say, I'm not a fishery scientist, so this sure. is not my active field of research. But so when regulations get put in place, they include things, for example, like what is the minimum size shark you can catch? And the reason mm-hmm. for that is you want to make sure if you're removing an animal that it's had chance to reproduce so that it can at the very least replace itself. So you would have a size limit. You can't catch an animal unless it's above this size. You then also have quotas. Like, yes, you can catch this animal. We're allowed to catch this many number of individuals per boat. When we look at some commercial fisheries, you know, there's certain quotas, and if that has been reached, then you can't catch any more for that season. And those are some of the regulations. And it's important to also realize that there's really two ways that, you know, fishing can kill sharks. There's targeted fishery, which means that you actually want to catch sharks. And then what's also a really big problem is what we call bycatch. And that is when you don't want to catch sharks, but they take the bait. So when you set long lines to catch tuna or swordfish, obviously the sharks in the water, they see a hook with bait on it, they can take it and die. But then there's also things we're trying to do there. So for example, we're trying to find ways to prevent sharks taking the bait and using things that may not necessarily prevent the animals you want to catch, like a tuna taking the bait, but will prevent a shark. So you can do, they're testing things like putting light stick, for example, or certain metals that you can put on there. And then there's other rules. So if a shark does take the bait and become hooked, that's okay if it's released and survives. And so then there's regulations on, for example, where how much line do you want to increase the chance that if a shark does take the bait, it can survive. And then when the fishermen bring it off the surface, they can release it and it will live. So those are some of the ways we can try to regulate fisheries. We also have international rules on trade, so there's what are known as CITES regulations, which don't have any impact on what a country does in terms of fishing, but it has an impact on what you can trade. So if you want to trade internationally and you have a species that is listed on CITES, that can mean, no, you can't ship, for example, meat or fins from this animal anywhere else because that's illegal. So that sort of helps. Tries to at least help the regulation of trade. And then there's other methods as well. So for example, marine protected areas is a common tool in marine conservation. And those are areas you basically set aside and you're like, they can have varying degrees of regulations, but the most advanced ones are like, you're not allowed to fish at all in this area. And the hope is that it allows populations of fish to grow and to thrive within these regions and perhaps even supply individuals that can go outside the protected area. Those can be tricky when applied to sharks because a lot of sharks move over a large area.
Yeah, they migrate.
Yeah, they move. So an MPA works well when you have animals that just stay in there. You know, so little sure. reef fish that stay in there, that worked well. So it doesn't mean that they're not useful. You just have to really design them properly. So you want to put them in the right locations. You want to have MPAs in locations that are really important to those animals. So there could be areas that are really important to foraging. It could be areas where they like to mate. It could be areas where they give birth. Those are areas that you can set aside that even though your animal may move over a much larger area, the really important part are protected. And so those are just some of the tools that we can try to use to aid conservation.
Oh, I love that. And now, Yanni, I know one of your missions, especially with the Nat Geo Shark Fest programming that you're featured on, but also in your own research, is to help excite people about sharks, about their behavior, about their conservation. And so would you mind talking a little bit about citizen science and how that helps or impacts your shark research?
Yeah. So, citizen science is the kind of the process where you can get non-scientists to essentially collect data. I've done a little bit. And so my personal experience has been with working with some of the shark ecotourism operations. And, those are operators that take people diving. You pay mm-hmm. to go diving in a cage or sometimes outside of a cage and you see sharks. And it's been a controversial topic because some of you have criticized that it conditions the sharks and makes the waters more dangerous and all these sorts of things. And so some of the research I was actually actively involved with was trying to understand, what impact this ecotourism operation had on the life, the history and the ecology of sharks. But some of the things we would do, for example, is the operators would go out every day, they take people diving, and they would keep a record of what species of sharks they would see and how many. And they were doing this because they were out in the water every day, almost every day of the year, sometimes going back 10, 20 years. So you have this unprecedented data set. Even though it's collected by non-scientists, they know their sharks. They know what species they were. They could obviously count how many there were. And so you had this, you know, very, very rich data set. And what's also important is obviously most people probably think the majority of my job is diving with sharks. And that's not true. I mean, I spend 70% of my time probably behind a computer in the office.
No, don't tell us that.
That's the truth. And the higher up you get, the smaller that percentage becomes. Because
that's part of
science. But it also means that I'm not on the water every day of the year.
Right.
So, but these operators are. And so they have a sort of a data set that just we aren't going to collect ourselves. It's just not happening. And so there's other similar things. So, for example, there's programs where again, divers go out, recreational divers, and they count sharks. And I have colleagues who are basically collecting this sort of shark count data worldwide. And obviously, there's always issues when you have non-scientists collecting data. They're not going to have the same sort of quality control or the same rigorous standards as the scientists would. They're more likely to make mistakes, things like that. But because there's so much data, because there's so many people diving, you kind of, the general picture will be there in that data because the sample size is so large. So it can be really valuable. Now, that, you know, that is citizen science is one thing. What you're also talking about is public outreach. And I kind of changed my tune on that a bit because I used to be like, that's not my problem. You know, I do the research. I'll publish it in a peer-reviewed journal, which is how we publish there. That's a scientific process. And that's my job. If you want to read what I've done, you go to the scientific journal and you read the paper. And I've changed my tune with that because I realized that that isn't good enough because, you know, part of conservation biology or just, you know, changing people's opinions of sharks is you have to be able to reach, and most people are not going to go to scientific journals, going to have a lot of jargon and statistics and stuff like that, which is just not going to be that interesting. I think being able to reach the public with your, you know, to convey your work, make it in a format that they can understand, but also what to hear is really, really important because I think, you know, so much happens when public changes their opinion. And we're seeing that. You know, again, I started grad school in 2000, and people's view of sharks then was very different to what it is now. I mean, again, we had some shark documentaries then. I think, you know, Shark Week and National Geographic were putting out stuff, but at a much, much smaller volume than what we're seeing now. And I think the reason we're seeing so much, you know, shark nature documentaries now is because the public wants to see that. Because, you know, I think more and more the public are seeing sharks in a favorable light. Certainly not everybody, but I think the proportion is getting much, much higher. And that aids conservation. It's much easier to get, you know, regulations put in place when the public behind it versus if they don't care or if they're actively opposed to it.
Yeah, well, and once again, that's why we love that you're featured on Nat Geo's Shark Fest, because it does. It gets people thinking about it, learning, excited. And you can't really be passionate about an animal unless you know something about it. And also, if you're fearful of sharks, I know a lot of times friends that I've had have watched some of these programs and actually learned, oh, these sharks are creatures, they're not killing machines. Maybe my fear is not super validated by what's actually really going on in the ocean. So, and then not to mention, I have several people that reach out to me each month always asking about jobs that you have, for instance, being a fish biologist or ecologist or marine biologist working in the ocean, helping protect these creatures. So I was wondering, because I have you here on the podcast, if you could just talk a little bit about what advice you'd give someone watching you featured on Nat Geo Shark Fest or reading some of your work. What can they do if they want to become a marine scientist?
Yeah. So, I mean, part of the reason I mentioned that the percentage of time I spend in the water is that it is important that people realize the reality of what the job is, right? Would be a misrepresentation to give this idea that we're just spent all day diving, that, you know.
You're not just like offshore from the Big Island of Hawaii by day and then at night sitting out looking over the water.
I'd have a hard time keeping my job because I don't think the university would find that particularly valuable contribution. So it's important to understand, you know, what the job entails. Because there's a lot of different jobs you can do if you want to work with shark. You know, that can range from, you know, marine science, you know, is sort of similar to the job I have. Or you can be involved with policy and regulations with fisheries, or you can be involved with pure conservation, work with NGOs, or you can work in ecotourism, which is, you know, not a scientific position, but like a dive instructor or dive guide, and you dive for sharks every day. So there's a variety of different things. I'm really just going to talk about the marine science aspect of things, what I do. And there's a few, you know, I get obviously a lot of inquiries about, you know, students when they come to my lab.
I was going to say, you probably get more inquiries than I do.
I do get a lot, and I give sort of some similar advice. And yeah, the first thing I would say is, if you're looking at a career in marine science, do not let it be driven by an obsession with one animal, right? Because that is from a career standpoint, is not good. As an example, at the faculty level, universities aren't putting out job applications for a shark biologist. That's not what they're looking for. They were looking for an animal ecologist, an animal physiologist, something like that. And so that's why I said I like to look at things from a broad perspective. And even though sharks are my favorite animals and the ones I enjoy working with the most, I don't just work with sharks. Even when I work with sharks, I try to answer broader, more general questions, because I want to convey that, would my work be of interest to somebody or scientist that doesn't care about sharks? Because, you know, not everyone does, and that's fine. But would the general sort of concepts I'm discussing be of interest to somebody who studies marine mammals or terrestrial mammals or reptiles?
Or
like
ocean
that.
Health.
Or something. Exactly. So try and keep it broad. And even if you are obsessed with shark, don't try and let that drive your career goals. I really avoid using the term shark scientist personally, because again, it really kind of pigeonholes you that you only work with one animal. And from a career standpoint, that's not a great approach to take. The other thing is, obviously, there's a variety of skills you want to build up as you are, you know, going through your, you know, education, high school, undergrad, graduate school. And obviously, field skills are an important one, you know, and I get this a lot. Actually, being able to drive boat is more important, I would say, overall than diving. Everyone thinks that diving is a really important part. A lot of my projects do include a lot of diving, but to be honest, it's because I like to dive and I develop projects that had diving in them. But the fact is that for a lot of the work, you don't have to dive to study shark. A lot more involves being on boats, catching sharks, tagging sharks, putting out equipment, things like that. So boat handling skills are really, really important. But what people or students neglect even more than that is how important quantitative skills are. By that, I mean things, you know, your math, statistics, coding. Those are the things, computer coding, those are the skills that are really, really important, because, you know, getting the data is one thing, and obviously it's tricky, but really a lot of the advancements we're seeing these days are from the analytical side of things. And there's been huge advancements in the statistical tools we use, the analytical tools we use over the last few decades. And that really has revealed a lot more to the data we collect. So I always tell students, you know, make sure you're good at math. Learn as much statistics as you can, learn as much computer programming as you can. But those are, especially, you know, when I'm looking at applicants to my lab, those are skills I really, really look for, because obviously you learn some of that as you go into graduate school, but the stronger your background, the easier it is for you. When I look at computer coding, I think of it like a language, right? It's basically a language. If you speak the language, you can do stuff, you know. You can do your statistical analysis as long as you speak the language. If you don't speak the language, it's very difficult to do. So gain as much experience as you can. Volunteer for research opportunities. Again, taking classes is great in terms of learning things, but there's a big difference between being able to go and take classes and being able to go and do research. Those are almost completely different things. So if you wanted to get into graduate school, when you're doing your undergrad, volunteer at other labs to get research experience. It doesn't have to be with sharks. It could be anything. But as long as once you start to see a student has research experience, then you know that they have at least been exposed to what research actually is. It's not just this sort of
and they're willing to come back for more.
They're willing to come back for more. They know it's not easy. They know it involves a lot of analysis and knows it involves a lot of tedious stuff. And they're still there. And so I think that's why seeing that on the CV is really important.
And Yannis, for people that love sharks but don't necessarily want to get into marine biology, what's your advice for how they could passively help conserve sharks and or the ocean?
Yeah, it's a good question. Again, you can, there's other ways to work with sharks that doesn't involve marine science. So that's not the only opportunity you have. But in general, you know, things I tell the public, first of all, you know, learn as much as you can about these animals. And then there are, you know, learn, for example, and it's not just about sharks, let's say marine conservation in general, learn what fisheries are sustainable, you know, because not all of them are. Are you, you know, and I eat fish. I'm not telling people not to eat fish. I think that's, you know, I would never say that because it's important sort of food for a lot of people. But just know that, find out if the fisheries you are getting your food from are sustainable ones. And there are groups that actually do that. They actually list, you know, what are some of the sustainable fisheries. So kind of do your homework. There's also organizations you can get involved with. But again, kind of do your homework, because just because an organization says we are experts in sharks and shark conservation doesn't mean that they are. So, you know, what are the sort of credentials of that organization, and are they valid? I know that's not necessarily easy to do, but just kind of search around and see what is, you know, the general figure that being said about that NGO. There's lots of very, very good NGOs that people can donate.
Absolutely. And I have to ask, for people that are interested in your research, your lab, is there any social media sites that you have where people could follow your work that you'd like to promote here?
Yeah. So the two things, so I have my own personal Twitter account, which is Dr_Yannis. And then my Instagram account is just Yannis Papastamatiou, one name. So obviously I post, you know, anything I publish, and then also, you know, updates from field work, pictures, video from field work, I always put stuff up there. So if people are interested in what I'm doing, they can find it there. I also, my lab is the Predator Ecology Conservation Lab, Florida International University. So we also have, you know, a separate Twitter and Instagram account for the PEC lab, as we call it, where, you know, you can also get updates on what, not just what I'm doing, but also the other graduate students and postdocs in my lab.
Awesome. And of course, we have to give a big shout out to National Geographic Shark Fest, which features shark-themed documentaries, shows the whole month of July. So definitely tune into the programming. And of course, you can see Yannis featured on When Sharks Attack 360, Sharkan of Hawaii, and Bull Shark versus Hammerhead. So please check those out. Give Dr. Yannis a follow on Instagram or other social media outlets. And we will be posting all of this information on our show notes and our Instagram at allcreaturespodcast.com as well. So we're promoting oceans and sharks and National Geographic Shark Fest all month long. So Yannis, I really want to thank you for your time and your passion and just helping educate us and excite us all about sharks and their behavior. It was such a pleasure to meet you. And I have one more really important question. Am I going to be able to get on a boat with you sometime?
I'm sure we can arrange that. I'm not sure where you're based in Florida, but we're a pretty big state, but not that big. So
I'm right in the center in Gainesville, so I'm just a few hours from pretty much anywhere, or I can be. So,
I lived in Gainesville for 3.5 years. So I was a postdoc at University of Florida. So I've spent a lot of time in Gainesville. I try to get up there once a year to go cave diving. I actually miss Gainesville quite a bit.
Okay, well, next time you're in town, let me know, and yeah, we'll schedule a boat ocean date maybe, and I would love to learn more and obviously keep this conversation going, because sharks need researchers like yourself, educators like myself coming together to help conserve them. So Thank you so, so much. Don't be a stranger. We'll be in touch. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you featured on a National Geographic Shark Fest. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me and letting me come on here and talk to you about definitely my favorite animal.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.